I have had Paula Canny, the attorney for Eliana Lopez, on a couple of times during this whole Mercurimi affair, and in terms of all of the legal proceedings and all of that. She represents Eliana Lopez. And it was quite an interesting last couple of weeks in that case. There are now allegations that Mayor Lee committed perjury not once but twice. At that hearing and testimony, there was a bomb threat. And probably the biggest bombshell is that despite all the people who said, oh, she'll never come back, Eliana Lopez will never come back to San Francisco, I think she's coming back. So is Paula Canny on the line with us now?
I am.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi there. You know, I was watching, I just want to talk to you about this. I was watching the hearing, and anybody can watch the last one on the 29th of June. And anybody can watch this on your computer. It's sfgovtv.org, and there are two channels there, one and two, and it was on one of those. You can watch the whole thing live. And I'm watching Shepard Kopp, who is one of Ross Mercurimi's lawyers, grilling the mayor questions about who he had or hadn't talked to before he came up with these charges against Ross Mercurimi to try to remove him for official misconduct. And the questioning was, I think the mayor was really getting clobbered there. He seemed extremely uneasy. Yeah. Pummeled. And it was very good lawyering, and he was having a lot of problem with those questions. And my jaw almost dropped when all of a sudden I see this big, strong kind of fellow, security kind of guy, come up to Lee and also to Ben Hur, the improbably named yet very able head of this commission. And all of a sudden, Mr. Hur says, we're going to adjourn. And I'm not sure whether we're coming back or not. We're adjourning right now. And you see the mayor get up and gets kind of whisked out of the room right in the middle of this incredibly intense questioning. My jaw just dropped. I said, what on earth just happened? What did you think? You were sitting in that courtroom because I could see you and Mr. Wagoner and Mr. Kopp and the audience there.
Well, what I thought is a couple things. I mean, the cross-examination of the mayor started at 1. Mm-hmm. It's interesting how they have that whole thing set up, because what the mayor was being cross-examined about was a declaration that the city attorney's office had submitted on his behalf that he'd clearly signed. And what was interesting is, as you were observing, what my experience was as well, as the cross-examination starts. And you know, there's an energy to cross-examination, good cross-examination. And you start out sort of like a boxing match. You do a little jab, jab, punch, punch. But at the point that you're speaking about, when Ben Hur said we're stopping these proceedings and when the mayor was whisked away, if it was a boxing match, Shepard Kopp was getting ready to land the knockout punch. That is how much the pummeling had increased from a jab, jab to just basically a question beating of the mayor. Clearly the mayor was not well prepared for that experience. It was clear the mayor had no idea what he was going to be asked about, and he was badly prepared.
And the mayor has made these charges. Paula has made these charges in a document, charging Mr. Mercurimi with official misconduct, et cetera, and trying to dissuade witnesses. Mm-hmm. And so it really becomes his job to show this. And so far, that's not been shown in this hearing. And so when Mr. Kopp was asking some very serious questions about the foundation for these charges, the mayor was just completely afield.
Exactly. I mean, I'm saying the same thing. The mayor was not prepared at all. And so I've practiced law for over 30 years. And I've had things happen in courtrooms where, for example, the power went out when a verdict was being read. And that was kind of scary. And everybody, when that happened, there was a whole set of security things that took place. The amazing thing about this instance was that as the security person, a guy who was, you know, spoke to Ben Hur, and then Ben Hur said, we're going to stop these proceedings, and the mayor was escorted out. The amazing thing to me was that the mayor was escorted out, and at the time, everybody thought it was a bomb threat in the building. Except nobody had been told that. We learned that maybe 30 seconds later, but the mayor was escorted out. and the rest of us were just left there to maybe be blown up or not.
That exactly. If they have to whisk him out of a specific room and yet they don't do anything to evacuate that room, you got to start scratching your head. Now, I understand from other folks who were there as well that none of the security guards at the building had any idea that there had been any sort of bomb threat, or at least they were not aware of anything. They keep letting other people into the building for weddings and this and that and all sorts of stuff.
Well, that's true. I mean, the interesting part about that is the Sheriff's Department of San Francisco is in charge of security for the building, but the Police Department is in charge of security for the mayor. So somehow the Police Department knew, but apparently the Sheriff's Department didn't know, because there are a whole set of protocols what to do in the event of a bomb threat, and none of those protocols were followed. And I'm not sure that the sheriff's office at the time thought that it was a bomb threat of the building. I mean, we've since heard, you know, that it was some bomb threat, that they were going to blow up the Golden Gate Bridge, some other spot, and there was a bomb outside of the building.
Well, because there was video of cops going from car to car looking into cars, supposedly for any signs of bombs along the road there.
Well, I'm not a super duper crime bomb solver, but the funny part is on Fridays, that's when the all the food trucks are out in front of the city hall. So I don't think any of the food trucks moved. I don't think there was much different activity. I don't remember seeing a bunch of, you know, police officers going around looking. I just remember everybody that was in the room, all of us are going, What is going on?
And here's the thing. When the mayor gets whisked away, he is still under oath at that point. And this it sort of completely obstructs, it stops the questioning right before the knockout punch. So you may think, is this coincidence? What on earth is going on here?
There was a lot of speculation about
there,
that.
There was. And hold the thought, because we need to take...
It's like, really?
Yeah, and I've got some more thoughts on it, Paula, but hold on a second. We need to take a break right here. We'll do this, come back, and then we'll discuss the bomb threats, Eliana Lopez's return, and many other things right here on KGO. I'm Christine Kraft, in for Carell tonight. He's doing a performance in San Francisco, and we'll be back with you next Saturday. In any event, my guest is Paula Canny. She's been on with us before. She's Eliana Lopez's lawyer, and she represents Eliana. Eliana's her client, not Mr. Mercurimi. We were talking about this bomb threat that occurred in the midst of testimony, where the mayor was really getting pummeled by attorney Shep Kopp, who represents Ross Mercurimi. And Paula, some have said, well, how could they ever have organized a bomb threat? And it's really quite simple if I think about it. I don't know what you think, but the thing's being televised live. So all it takes is a phone call from, I mean, I can't imagine that the only person who has the phone number for the sheriff's security patrol is the mayor's security patrol is the mayor himself. I'm sure that there are others close to the mayor that have that phone number. All someone had to do was get him off that stand right now. 90 minutes ensued, and then testimony resumed. What happened then?
Well, when we came back, I mean, even that was sort of interesting, because we all were sort of scattered to the wind, and we were told at one point not to come back, that we wouldn't resume for the day. And so there's, you know, that sort of is a deflating of experience. And so when we came back, the mayor had clearly been prepared. In the time period that we were not in session, clearly, his attorneys or somebody had properly prepared him, and he was more effective. Also, because Shep had been interrupted, it was sort of hard to get the rhythm back. But one of the reasons he didn't get that sort of pummeling rhythm back is because clearly the mayor had been far more prepared. So, you know, it was somewhat anticlimactic to come back. It was like, you know, we didn't get the knockout punch, and there was a, you know, hour and a half delay, and the mayor had been better prepared, and that's sort of what happened. But the point of it is, even before the proceedings were interrupted,
yes,
as you correctly point out, it's on television. Anybody
that's
watching that would have thought, oh, my.
Anybody with an interest who wants to be him to be better prepared, yes, can make that phone call if they're connected enough. Absolutely. We don't know precisely what happened, but it sure feels that way.
Well, it felt that way to all of us that was present because, as I said, only the mayor was whisked away. They left the rest of us. I mean, I know that we might have upset some people, but I'm pretty sure if it was a real bomb threat, they wouldn't want it of us all to have been blown up. They might.
Now, like Paula, this was one of those Ed Lee neutron bombs, which only would have harmed him.
Well, maybe. I mean, who knows? I have no idea, but it was weird. But the point is, even though Shep didn't get to land the knockout punch, ironically, he had laid the seeds for what now all the discussion is about.
Allegations of perjury, yes.
Yes, the mayor said that he didn't discuss his decision to remove Sheriff Mercurimi from office with any supervisor before he did that. And so then there was the discussion that Deborah Walker said that Supervisor Christina Olege had told her that the mayor had discussed it with her. Then there was the discussion about former Supervisor Aaron Peskin having had a conversation with Walter Wong vis-a-vis the mayor's office to offered to some alternative plan for Ross should he agree to resign. So there are two instances where these collateral people, these outside people, have said things that contradict what the mayor said. So, you know, that's a problem. And interestingly, I mean, in the mayor saying, I didn't discuss this with any supervisor, I mean, I think that's an interesting thing. I mean, if I were mayor, I would certainly discuss my decision to remove an elected official from office with other elected officials. I mean, that is a major, major, major decision to make. So as a leader, I would expect to have gathered support from other leaders to remove an elected official from office is a really big deal. So yeah. It was a really interesting hour and a half to listen to the mayor.
Well, so now there are these allegations of perjury, and I'm presuming there have been press accounts that Mr. Kopp plans to get some under oath testimony from some of the principals involved here who have been talking about this, and it'll be interesting to see if that occurs on July 18th. But what I really want to ask you about, and of course it's related, yet it's sort of a separate question, whether the mayor perjured himself, a felony, which has, you know, arguably a felony, under oath, perjury of that sort, whether that undercuts his credibility, yeah, I would think so if it's the case. Mr. Gascon says he will investigate if there are credible information about such, which really upsets all of this. But what I find most interesting is that people have been saying all along, many opponents of the sheriff, that, oh, Eliana Lopez, you know, she's was battered and she's just defending him because she's, you know, so weak and whatever. There's no way she's coming back from Venezuela. You asked the city was asked to pay for that ticket back up and then back down again. They said no. They've spent many thousands of dollars on that report from Ms. Lemon at Bolt about how, you know, about domestic violence, not based on any direct observation of either one of them. They brought in the police chief from San Diego who doesn't know about our sheriff's department and how it operates, et cetera. Spent lots and lots, many times the amount of money that they could spend bringing Eliana back. They refused to do so. But then I understand now there are a couple of fundraising drives to raise money to bring her back, and I believe she is coming back. Is that the case?
That is correct. I mean, there were a number of fundraising efforts, and the money has been gathered, and consequently, the funds are available, and a ticket has been purchased, and she will be back to testify in person. Because, you see, it's interesting, in sort of thinking about how to best and most effectively represent Eliana, she submitted a declaration. The city attorney's office wants to cross-examine her. And I had thought that the most effective way to cross-examine somebody is to have them be there in person. But then when they refused to do that, because I was saying she's outside of the subpoena power of the tribunal, I said, right, she'll come back, just pay for her ticket. Mm-hmm. And when they declined to do that, I mean, in sort of thinking about it, I think that they want to keep Eliana, in some ways, is sort of a two-dimensional person and not the three-dimensional person. So sort of a further effort to sort of marginalize her, to see her as a caricature, like as the Lemon, you know,
documents.
Declaration says, as opposed to somebody, a person. So the other thing is I couldn't figure out, frankly, how I was going to represent her doing a video conference because I'm in not in the place where she is. So after a lot of consideration, you know, she decided this is what she wanted to do. Then the funds were gathered, and so that's what's going to happen. The other thing about scheduling is an awful lot supposed to happen on the evening of the 18th. So
yes, it is.
I'll have to speak with the chair of the Ethics Commission, the attorney for the Ethics Commission, Scott Umbridge, and see what he says regarding scheduling, because it'll either be probably Tuesday or Wednesday night.
That's right, one of those two nights. And I would urge everyone who's interested in this, and there are many people outside of San Francisco who are very interested in what I think is really an attempt at a political lynching, who may want to watch both of these evenings. SFGovTV.org enables you to do that. You know, Paula, I'm looking through Eliana's declaration.
Right.
And signed under penalty of perjury, et cetera, in which she describes that time when she made the 45-second videotape with her neighbor, Ms. Madison.
Right.
And she describes how Ms. Madison told her, oh, don't wear any makeup, just wear your pajamas, look all rumpled up. And that's what she describes, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, sort of in retrospect, I'm sure what Ms. Lopez will say when cross-examined is that she regrets making the videotape, that, you know, it was... Madison promised her it would be confidential and secret, promised her it was her property, promised she wouldn't tell anybody about it. Eliana thought it was protected by an attorney-client privilege, which for now, you know, the irony of it is that when you discuss what's contained, you're deemed to have waived the privilege. But at this point, she and I have decided, since everybody already knows...
Horses out, yeah.
...with it, she might as well just come and... deal with it all head on. I think she'll be an effective witness, and she's a great person. I've really enjoyed the experience of getting to know her and getting to work with her, and I think she's great.
Now, when she comes back, she's not going to be able to stay in her own, or she will be able to stay in her own house, but if she does, her husband will have to leave again, right?
That's correct, because of the criminal stay-away order still in existence. So, no, we've made an alternative arrangement so Ross can stay in his home and Eliana will stay in another place.
Some of the exhibits that were submitted with that declaration included, despite Ms. Madison's and her husband saying that she's never presented herself as a lawyer, the inner page of her one of her female vengeance superhero comic books in which it says she's was a lawyer.
Exactly. I mean, the comic book, The Huntress, she was responsible for the editorial comment and what it was said on the book about her, and it says in the description about her that she had been a lawyer, which bolsters all of the other things which I've explained, is that you go to the various websites.
LinkedIn.
Says, yeah, trained as an attorney, editor
in chief
of the Law Review, law clerk at the California Supreme Court. It's true she never does say that she's licensed to practice law in the state of California. But again, in Venezuela, you're an attorney. And under Venezuelan law, as soon as you graduate from law school, they don't have a traditional bar licensing. Just like in certain states in the United States. I don't think Vermont has a bar exam.
If only I'd gone to law school in Vermont.
Exactly.
Paula, because you remember that grueling experience. Perhaps Miss Madison is studying for the July bar right now. In any event, can you stay with us a bit longer?
Yeah, sure.
Because I need to go to news, and I know also you did a lot of commentary during the Scott Peterson trial. He's got an appeal that's just filed. I want your comments on that, too.
Well, I'd love to.
I'm Christine Kraft. I'm in for Carell. Paula Canny, Eliana Lopez's lawyer, is with us on the KGO Live Line. I've got a bunch more to ask her. I want to look at the Eliana Lopez's declaration that was filed with the commission once more and read to you, to our audience, a segment of this and then get your take on this, Paula.
Okay.
It describes how on January 4th, Eliana was busy So she visited Ivory on January 4th after she'd gotten a little boy ready for school.
Right.
And she says she went to Ivory's home at around 9 a.m. Ivory told me, and I'm going to read a little bit here, that she had talked to a friend of hers who had gotten a divorce, and that the way this person gained custody of his child was by accusing his ex-wife of being a bad mother and a bad person, and that I should do the same. Ivory told me that I should accuse Ross of domestic violence so that I could get custody of Theo. Ivory told me that the way to do it was that Phil Bronstein, and that's her good friend, Mr. Bronstein, would call the police chief, the district attorney, and a third person whom I cannot remember now. We would all meet in Ivory and Abe's house as my attorney's office. By the way, Mr. Madison, it's Abraham Mertens, is a lawyer and does have his law office in the home there. Ivory and Mertens' office is in their home. Ivory asked me to show her my arm. The bruise was almost gone. Ivory said, Eliana, we have to do it now. Tomorrow it will be gone. She told me not to take a shower, not to put on any makeup, and to keep myself in pajamas so that I looked as disheveled as possible. Ivory spent more than an hour trying to convince me that calling the police was the only way to be free of Ross, and it goes on and on. I urge everyone to read these declarations. She will be cross-examined on this. Is there any plan of having Ivory Madison come in to testify, do you think?
I think that what I heard, it's interesting. I don't think that she's willing to come in and submit to cross-examination. I think that it's interesting because there's no game plan, and I don't mean it so flip as that sounds. There isn't a procedure set forth in the city charter to determine how the Ethics Commission is supposed to conduct their review before
exactly.
they make their finding and recommendations. So they invented this procedure that they thought would be less cumbersome, which is to have witnesses submit declarations. But then what happened is when the city attorney's office submitted the Ivory Madison declaration, it was so filled with irrelevant stuff and
poisoning the well is what one commissioner called it, a lot of hearsay poisoning the well.
Well, poisoning the well, I think one of the other commissioners said that a first-year law student would have known not to have included most of what was in that declaration. So what happened is, you know, the commission in going through it excised most of it, and as I understand it, I heard that that, you know, Madison has an attorney that through her attorney that she was just so upset by the whole thing, she won't come in to be subjected to cross-examination.
Doesn't want any public scrutiny. But, you know, I don't know if you've seen this one, but Dan Noyes from ABC7 did a great report, a week and a half ago or so, in which he got a hold of the highly redacted, but still, readable. If you look at all of it, lots and lots of emails and messages that Miss Madison sent out between the time she got Eliana to make this videotape. She even says, she even let me videotape her to her friends.
Right.
And sends out, we don't know who the recipients were, but apparently they were very long, and as Dan Noyes, not in the habit of saying things that are not repertorial, said that they were very embellished hearsay accounts of things that, you know, she did not observe. But sent these emails out, I saw one of them, I sort of did a screen freeze on one of them that says, I'm asking for your help, asking people basically for their assistance in getting this story out there into the community. Before she ever even called the police. And then sort of, it was odd to me because Miss Madison, at least through her husband, had said, she called the police, had no idea that meant making a case. But then it's revealed that Mr. Bronstein told her precisely when to call the police. So I think she'd be a very important witness, don't you?
Well, I mean, important witness as to how. I mean, she should be the star witness of the city attorney's case.
Right.
She's basically, and they've basically undercut, in a lot of ways, whatever credibility or testimony would have. And given the fact that she's now refusing to come and submit to cross-examination, the Ethics Commission has said that they're going to, therefore, you know, not give great weight to her
right.
testimony.
What's left of her testimony.
In terms of that whole backstory, though, I mean, that's part of the reason why I think Eliana wants to come to court. Remember, the video was made January 1st. The conversation we're talking about took place on January 4th.
Mm-hmm.
And on January 4th, Madison is trying to convince Eliana to call the police. Eliana is saying, and I think she says it in Eliana's declaration, she said that she said to Madison that plan might work in one of her comic books, but she does not want to do that. She didn't feel the need for intervention, and she didn't want the police called. And
she wanted advice about divorce and custody, and she basically got, as Miss Madison says in her own email, I even got her to let me videotape her. It seems that there was some degree of at least guidance, coercion, whatever.
Well, the thing is, again, if somebody came to me and asked my advice, and I'm being a lawyer, and they think that they can trust me to be confidential, that they can trust me to keep my mouth shut, and then they find out a couple days later they've been, you know, blabbing to a bunch of people, it's really disconcerting. It's very unsettling, and it feels quite betraying and invasive, and it was really a bad experience. I to this day, I'm sure that Ms. Lopez is going to come and say that she regrets having chosen, you know, Ivory Madison to be the one to ask for advice from.
Now, she's coming back, and I would imagine, I don't know, you know her and speak with her, is she kind of excited about this chance to really set the record straight and to at least be heard? Because many people said, oh, kind of speaking for her, infantilizing her as if she can't know her own mind, including the mayor, including some in the leaders of the so-called domestic violence community. You and I have no affection for domestic violence. I would argue that an arm grab does not an abuser make. But in any event, I would imagine she feels very strongly about coming back and being heard.
I think that the thing that Eliana feels most strongly about is the concept of democracy, the concept that what has transpired here is that the mayor, as an elected official, has unilaterally removed another elected official from office. I mean, the reality of it is it's 6 months. The mayor could stop this madness. And if the voters wanted to recall Ross from office,
they could.
Democracy should work, and that's what should happen. But I think that Eliana is most concerned about the process. In terms of being excited to come back, none of this is exciting to her. She hasn't seen her husband. Her contact with her husband is limited. He's lost his job. He doesn't have a paycheck. Nobody has really considered that which she asked. She certainly said, as she said in the declaration, the mayor never asked her. Nobody really has spoken to her. When efforts were made to try to assert attorney-client privilege regarding Madison, shot down. Same with Merton, shot down. So I think that she feels a little frustrated about.
But she must know that there are people who are not, there's really been a change in a generalized point of view about this. I from the beginning knew that there was something screwy about all of it, but many people who didn't now are starting to see, and their people are raising money to bring her back. That must give her some solace, don't you think?
Well, I think it does. I mean, absolutely, to know that eventually, you know, the truth is slowly being revealed.
Exactly.
I mean, that's the great part about truth. It eventually comes out.
It does.